peer pressure can sometimes be a bad thing, but let's consider how it can be a powerful force for good. In Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World, Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award-winning author Tina Rosenberg discusses how the human desire to be like others and win their respect reduce the rate of AIDS transmission in South Africa, help minority students ace calculus in Texas, fought poverty and its attendant diseases in rural India, and even toppled a dictator in Serbia. The book is published by W.W. Norton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Tina Rosenberg to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You've written about political violence in Latin America and the problems faced by post-communist Europe. How did you get interested in the impact of peer pressure?
Yeah, it's kind of a different story for me. Well, I started to think about it because I realized I had begun to write the same story over and over again. I was working on the story of the young group of students in Serbia who formed a group in 1998 with 11 people that they aimed at overthrowing Slobodan Milosevic. And 2 years later, they had turned into 70,000 people. And they did it with a very unusual strategy that I had never seen before. And that was to make political activism just the coolest thing to do. They had decided that there was no reason to give Serbs information. People already knew that they lived in a dictatorship. What they needed was motivation. And so what would get somebody out of their house and into the street in a country that was very fearful and apathetic? And they used the guiding spirit of Monty Python's Flying Circus, essentially. They used street theater and pranks, and they gradually grew their movement. They had really cool graphics and T-shirts.
They created a thing called Atpor.
Yes, that means resistance.
Now, we've seen a whole bunch of movements develop more recently. Do we see any similarities, or was this a lot more benign than the sort of thing that we've been seeing in Egypt, Libya, Yemen, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, to name a few?
You do see a similarity with some, and it's not a coincidence. The Atpor kids, who are no longer kids, they're now in their mid-30s, started to train other democracy movements. And they taught their tactics to people in Georgia and Ukraine and other places. And one of the groups they trained was the April 6th movement in Egypt. So a lot of the tactics that you saw in Tahrir Square were taken from Atpor.
They actually made Atpor into a brand.
Right.
So they were
right.
Using marketing strategies.
Exactly. They were modeled after Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Coca-Cola.
And they figured out how to use the media. Of course, the media has to be cooperative.
Yes. And Serbia had some advantages.
Have to be cooperative.
Yes. Right. Serbia had some advantages. There were opposition media in Serbia. Some countries where people are trying to do this, there are not, and that makes a big difference.
Now, let's get back to the whole idea of peer pressure. Why are we so susceptible to it? I'm sure you spoke to any number of psychologists to get that question answered.
Well, we're groupists. Humans need to be with other humans. That's just – it's evolutionary. It's part of our makeup. And one of the most powerful things that drives us is the desire to belong.
Even though we'd like to believe that we're all individual and
we are all
that
individual.
Groucho Marx was speaking first when he said he didn't want to join any club that would have him.
You know, we all are individuals and we all make choices about what we do. But the drive to fit in somewhere, to have the respect of our peers is really quite overwhelming, more so for some groups than for others, teenagers, for example.
Uh-huh.
So when I started work on the Atpor story, I realized I had already written this almost the same story in South Africa. And that was the story of the campaign to for teen AIDS prevention. And that used very similar strategies.
Well, in that case, it's interesting that when it started, the government was taking a very different tack.
Right. They had had a not very effective strategy against AIDS in South Africa. It had not been one of their priorities, even though in retrospect it certainly should have been. It was very difficult for people in South Africa to talk about sex and to talk about AIDS. It was really not part of the culture there. And they had used the traditional, let's give teens information and let's scare them to death. Those are the two main tactics. And they weren't working.
But also Thabo Mbeki was saying that AIDS was not connected to HIV. So you then had to convince people that the president of the country had it all wrong.
He was inexplicably irrational on this issue. I mean, otherwise a fairly sane person. Well, the group I was talking about was not working on the issue of AIDS treatment, which is what Mbeki was more concerned about. They were really working on AIDS prevention. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they set up a bunch of clubs throughout the country and in school, after school, and they decided that what kids needed was not information, because everybody knew how you get AIDS and what it does to you. They had to have a reason to apply that information to themselves. And so they had to have a vision of a more positive future.
And they came up with a name that sounds almost like a product. Love,
love
Life.
Love Life.
With a lowercase L.
Right.
And then a capital L, one word.
In my book, there's an awful lot of brand names with lowercase initial letters. Seems to be very popular. Yes, and if you go to Love Life's website, you will see it looks like a fashion magazine. It's about popular rock stars and clothes and gossip, and there's a dating advice column. There's very little visible about AIDS. It's a really unusual strategy.
My guest is Tina Rosenberg, whose latest book is Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. It's published by Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Where does Love Life get its funding?
South African government. It's a government program. And that, in turn, a lot of it comes from the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria.
In discussing the AIDS problem in South Africa in the past, we learned that one of the big problems is that many people don't believe that they can get it. They don't consider themselves at risk
right.
of HIV.
Right. They would look at people with the same risk profile they have, and they'd point to their neighbor and say, he's at risk.
And then
I'm not at risk.
And then also they didn't want to go and be tested because that might actually cause them to be concerned about themselves.
Yes. The power of denial is extremely strong. And a lot of it is the idea that if I'm found positive for this disease, I'll be an outsider. I'll be an outcast, because that is how South Africa was treating people with AIDS at the time.
So how does Love Life get around all of that?
Well, it really focuses on helping teens to not do the behaviors that will get them sick to begin with. Avoiding risky sex. Don't get a sugar daddy to give you clothes and cell phone minutes and spending money in exchange for sex with an older man who might be more likely to be infected. They really focus on showing kids the possibilities for their lives, and they use peers, obviously. They take a lot of kids who are in the same situation, and they have them teach the classes and work with the kids. And they try and give these teenagers a sense that there's something to have there's a future for you. There is a future for you. Make good choices.
And how effective has this campaign been?
It's been effective. South Africa's numbers of the AIDS prevalence numbers in South Africa have been dropping. They have been dropping everywhere. But in South Africa, what you see that you don't see everywhere is an absolutely dramatic drop in the number of teenagers acquiring AIDS.
Where does what you call the social cure come into all of this?
The social cure is what I call this strategy. And that is helping people to change their behavior, not by giving them information, not by appealing to fear, but by giving them a new peer group that they can identify with.
Well, you mentioned it could be effective with teens, but does it affect all classes?
Yes, equal opportunity. I have several stories in the book of this strategy working with adults. It works.
Well, AA, wouldn't AA
be an
example?
AA is a classic example. In fact, if you'd have asked me before I started writing, where can peer pressure be used for positive effect? AA probably would have been the only thing I could have thought of. Now I see it in many places, and I see the potential for it in many places.
But in the case of AA, is it the organization that applies the peer pressure? Or, I mean, it does after you join, but isn't it peer pressure that forces you to go there in the first place? People are denying that they have a problem until they're finally too many people tell them, you're an alcoholic and you're ruining your life.
That is also a form of peer pressure.
Yeah.
But what I'm really talking about is what happens once you get to the meetings. You have
the
a group of people.
The organized peer pressure.
Right. But there is no organization of AA. AA is the people who go. And they hold each other accountable and they support each other. And this strategy has really now become the go-to strategy for addiction, personal behaviors of that kind. But I see ways to apply it on a much more wide basis.
Beginning in the 1990s, the state of Florida has had a successful campaign to combat smoking among teenagers, led by Chuck Wolf, an aide to the then Governor Lawton Chiles. How did Wolf decide to involve teenagers in the design of the campaign?
He had gone to California, which had a had done a very successful anti-smoking campaign that was not aimed at teenagers. And Wolf had also been the president of the National Explorer Scouts. And he told me that back then the organization relied heavily on the scouts themselves to organize things. And he said that he realized that that could really work to involve people. This Florida campaign was really extraordinary. Just think back to 1998. Teen smoking, the year before that, 36.7% of all high school seniors smoked. It's a huge amount. And no one had the slightest idea what to do about it. It was really a problem that no one knew how to solve. And then along comes Florida, which says, what is it? Actually, the key, what they did was they hired an advertising agency. This was a campaign not run by public health officials. Very important. It was run by advertisers. And the advertisers sat down and said, why do people smoke? Well, adults smoke mostly because they're addicted. But why do teenagers start to smoke? For a teenager, a cigarette is not a delivery system for nicotine. It's a delivery system for rebellion. Kids smoke so they can be anti-authority and defy people and show that they're autonomous and rebellious. Let's think of another way we can give kids those satisfactions by having them join clubs where they can rebel against the tobacco companies who are manipulating them.
But don't teenagers also start smoking because other teenagers are smoking? That's peer pressure. I know that's how I got started smoking initially. I went on dates with girls who smoked and bought a pack of cigarettes, and after a while, I started smoking those cigarettes as well.
Well,
18 years later, I was finally able to kick the habit.
Yeah, if you don't start smoking when you're a teenager, you're probably never going to start. Yes, people start because the people around them do, but it's a vicious circle that Florida turned into a virtuous circle. It became cool to say to the tobacco companies, stop manipulating us.
And then Jeb Bush, when he was governor of Florida, cut funding for it?
Yes.
The problem, what was his reason?
Well, the tobacco companies don't like this strategy because it works. This is the big problem of this strategy. It's extremely effective. But in most states, it has lost its funding because the tobacco companies fight like hell against it.
And what were the kids doing? They were getting together and saying, we hate tobacco companies?
Well, it was a two-step strategy. They had a lot of money at the time to do television. So they did TV ads that the kids wrote themselves. And they were very unusual TV ads. They would show the kids making prank phone calls, for example, to advertisers who did tobacco advertising. Or they filmed a road trip where they went up to Richmond, Virginia, which is the headquarters of Philip Morris. And then they went to the gate and they asked the guard, can we see the Marlboro Man? And the guard, clueless man, said, oh, he's dead. And in fact, he had just died of lung cancer. And they filmed the whole thing and they put it on the air. And they did a focus group afterwards asking teenagers who they thought was behind these ads. And nobody got the right answer, which was the Florida Department of Health. That's who was financing it. Teenagers thought other teenagers were financing it. Then they also had clubs in every county, and they would put on public events. They would stage protests. It was, you know, similar to the strategies Otpor was using in Serbia.
And then there was the rage against the Hayes campaign in South Carolina.
This spread to other states. Chuck Wolf then became the director of a national foundation doing the same thing. And so many states started the same thing that Florida had been doing, only unfortunately they didn't have as much money to do TV ads. But I visited a group in South Carolina called Rage Against the Hayes. You can tell it by the name what the focus of the group is. That was using many of the same tactics and very successfully.
And what happened to that program?
It lost its funding. Same thing. You see,
it becomes a political football.
Well,
even though we don't want kids to smoke.
We don't want kids to smoke.
It's in the best interest of the health industry for people not to smoke.
Yes. But the tobacco industry is extremely powerful. And the problem is that politicians are often content to advocate strategies for their ad campaigns that don't work very well, warning kids of the health effects of smoking, because the public thinks those are effective. They're not.
Well, we've been seeing them in New York recently, people who are on oxygen tents, and they're rather horrible to watch.
Yes, New York has tried to gross everybody out. New York has also been extremely successful, but I think for different reasons. New York has made you a social outcast if you smoke because you have to go outside. You can't even smoke in a bar anymore, and has raised taxes. I think New York's cigarette taxes are the highest in the nation. So that also works.
I love this New Yorker cartoon in which there are a bunch of people in front of a bar, and one man is saying, I think I'll go inside and get some fresh air. Tina Rosenberg, her latest book is Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. It's published by W.W. Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Tina Rosenberg, who was not only the first freelance journalist to receive a MacArthur Fellowship, but has also won a Pulitzer and a National Book Award. Her latest book is called Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World. It's published by Norton. It almost sounds to me, Tina, like you wanted to write a book that was a little more positive than the previous ones.
There was a little bit of that. I had been writing for most of my career about terrible problems afflicting the world, and I started to write more stories that looked at how people were solving some of them. And when I found a pattern, then I decided, well, maybe it's time to connect the dots.
Let's talk about how peer pressure can help students succeed in math. You write about Yuri Treisman, who came up with a way to help minority students pass college calculus exams. Who was he?
He was a grad student in math at Berkeley in the 1970s and noticed that minority students, black and Latinos mostly, were doing very poorly in calculus. This was important because if you didn't do well in calculus, you could not go on to a career in the sciences or in math or medicine. And the kids who were not doing well in calculus included kids who had taken calculus and done well in it in high school. But when they took it as freshmen in college, they flunked or they got D's. And Treisman decided to try and figure out why that was and whether the university could do anything about it. So he took a movie camera, and he spent the next year and a half essentially living in two different dorms. One was a dorm where 20 Chinese students who were very good in calculus lived, and another was a dorm where 20 black students who were struggling in calculus lived. And he found at the end of this experience that the big difference between them was the black students tended to study alone and the Chinese students tended to study in groups. And this was something that maybe no one had noticed before, or if they had noticed it, they hadn't thought it was important. But Treisman realized that it was extremely important. So he set up calculus discussion sections that were different. They were group work. They were not remedial in any way. They were extremely challenging problems, more challenging than the homework. But the students were there to teach each other. There was a teaching assistant, but he did not help the students solve anything. He would just be there to help guide the discussion. And the students would work in groups of three or four, and they would work on these very challenging problems. And it has been phenomenally successful. It's been adopted now in 150 different universities, at least, throughout the United States. And the kids in these kinds of classes get sometimes three-quarters of a grade point higher than kids who are not.
Aren't we also more likely to spend more time studying when we're in a group than if we're just doing it alone?
That was part of it. The kids did spend more time, but when they were studying in a group, they had several advantages. One was they had to learn the material well enough to be able to explain it to someone else. They could feel comfortable asking questions. A lot of times people will not raise their hand in a 40-person discussion section because they don't want to look like they're stupid. And they had a sense of where they were. They had a sense of what was a really hard problem that nobody was getting or what was just a problem that they weren't getting. And for a lot of the kids, one student I interviewed at University of Texas told me that he had never had a peer group before where it was okay to like math. This was the first time he had a group of people around him who really liked math, who were into math. He had math friends.
Because perhaps where he went to school, other kids might have just seen him as a weirdo and a nerd.
Acting white. You were acting white.
So stereotyping plays a role in all of this.
Yes, it does. And self-stereotyping plays a role in all this.
What experiments did Aronson and Steele do in this area?
Well, this is about they did experiments in stereotype threat, which is a phenomenon where people who are aware of the stereotype of the group they fit into tend to conform to those stereotypes. And there's been some really interesting experiments in this. One of the most interesting took place in 2008, where a professor from Vanderbilt University gave a list of questions, an exam, to black adults and to white adults. And he did it four times during the year. And twice the whites outscored the blacks. And twice the two groups came out equal. Guess what the difference was?
Group study.
Obama.
Oh.
It was Obama. The times when the blacks did equally well as the whites were right after the Democratic convention and right after the election. So
they
having
were able
that,
to break out of the stereotype
exactly,
that was trapping them.
Having that role model allowed them to think of themselves in a different way.
Yeah, well, a lot of this seems to be about getting outside the conventional wisdom. What if in dealing with any of these issues, whether it's with a group or not, because there are certain patterns that we all fall into, and this is a way of getting us to break out of those patterns.
Part of the problem is that strategies for behavioral change are almost by definition designed by experts. But experts are sometimes the wrong people, because what motivates you as an expert isn't necessarily what motivates the people you're trying to reach. Experts have a problem getting inside people's heads.
Let's talk about microcredit, because Muhammad Yunus has been on the show a couple of times and been reading recently about his difficulties in Bangladesh. What did he do, and is the current situation undermining any faith in the microcredit approach that he has established?
Well, what's going on right now in Bangladesh is the government is trying to force him out of Grameen Bank and essentially is making moves to take it over, which would be absolutely disastrous.
So this is a political thing?
This is totally political. They don't like the fact that he has been a rather open critic of the government. It has nothing to do with the success or failure of microcredit. But what he did was when he began microlending in Bangladesh a long time ago, he solved a problem that had kept the poor from being able to get bank loans, which was that banks, first of all, would not lend to people who didn't have any conventional collateral. And second of all, these loans were so small that no bank would have gone to the trouble of trying to verify that you were creditworthy. The transaction cost would just be way too high for small loans. So what Yunus came up with that was really genius was taking that burden of determining creditworthiness and shifting it to the borrowers instead by forming them into groups. And you only would let people in your group if you were confident they would repay their loans.
And peer pressure forced people to pay their loans.
Yes.
But there have been – some of these programs have been running into trouble recently.
Yes, some of them have.
Because of the global economic crisis?
Well, you have a situation where a lot of banks that are traditional commercial banks are going into microlending, and they're charging exorbitant rates, and it's a problem. It's a very widespread practice now, and it affects hundreds of millions of people. And in a situation like that, there's going to be abuses of it.
You write about a city I've never heard of it called Jamshed in Maharashtra state in India, where a couple named Raj and Mabel Arol instigated a transformation. What happened there?
Raj Aroli was from the area, and he and Mabel, who had gone to medical school together and afterwards studied public health, they came back to the Jamshed area, which is very poor, very drought-stricken, and decided that they would try and improve village health. And they first tried putting nurses in the villages, but nurses wouldn't stay, and they were too foreign from the people in the villages to be able to have credibility. So then they hit on the idea of training exactly the opposite of who you'd think you would want as your village doctor. They took the most downtrodden women, women who were from the Dalit or untouchable caste, women who – some women I'd met had been married at the age of 2.5, women who had leprosy, people who had no credibility, who had no respect in their villages. And they gave them training in basic preventive health care. But what made it succeed was not teaching the women the skills, which was the easy part. It was giving them the confidence to approach their neighbors.
So this was as much about breaking down the caste system as it was about improving public health?
Eventually, it broke down the caste system in many of these villages because these untouchable women proved that they had something to say, that they were valuable resources in their village. They were helping people. They would go into people's houses, and when the woman was there to try and cure your child, you couldn't maintain the caste traditions that meant she couldn't touch anything and she had to drink out of a broken cup. So the caste system in these villages softened. But what helped these women gain the confidence was their relationships with each other. When they started, they would go to the village of a woman who had been in the program before, and they would watch her deal boldly and assertively with her neighbors. And they would come back every Tuesday. They still do, many of them, to Jamked. And they spend the night. They learn about a new health issue, but they also have this sisterhood, this fellowship.
You're right about a couple of programs in London that seek to dissuade potential Islamic terrorists from violent action. What's the street program?
The street program. I don't want to make too much of this. I'm not saying that this is a solution to global terrorism, but I do think this is a potential solution that needs to be tried. I think most of us can wrap our heads around the idea that people join cults in part because of peer pressure. It's not that you love the ideas and then you join and then you meet the people. It's usually the other way around. You fall in with the group, and then that group gradually becomes stronger and stronger for you, and you start to shut out everyone else and you're in a cocoon.
And not just cults, gangs.
Gangs,
as well.
And yes, gangs also, and terrorist groups as well. And so the idea is to take this circle, this vicious circle, and turn it into a virtuous circle by giving young men who are susceptible to terrorism a new group to belong to that's made up of people who are very much like them in almost every way, except one: they're nonviolent. They don't believe terrorism is the answer. So street is a group that it's a drop-in center. It does a lot of anti-gang work. It's from a perspective of very fundamentalist Salafi Islam. The people who worked there, many of them were former gang members or people who were formerly interested in terrorism themselves. And so they have street cred.
And the same thing is being done with former prisoners, where gang members help other gang members to rehabilitate themselves?
Yeah, that's done on a fairly wide basis these days.
But I wonder about peer pressure can work in all sorts of different ways. Earlier, we spoke with Kim Barker. The first question she asked people in Pakistan was, do you believe Jews died in the 9/11 attacks? And the great majority said no. And they wanted proof that at least one Jew had died because they saw it all as a Jewish conspiracy. When you're working within that kind of a mindset, isn't it difficult to then introduce logic as to how terrorism is really going against your best interest?
But nobody's talking about introducing logic. This is the whole point. It's messages that if they came from official sources, it would be completely ignored. But since these messages come from people like you, people who believed many of the same things and who still may share many of your grievances but just believe that the solution is somewhat different, these messages have impact.
You write the Fixes online column for the New York Times. What do you write about there?
This is a column that David Bornstein and I write together, and we write about solutions to different social problems.
Such as the things that you've written about in this book?
Some of them, yes. But it's not limited to just peer pressure.
You moved to South America to write Children of Cain, Violence and the Violent in Latin America. Do you ever go back?
Yes, I do go back. I really love South America.
And have you seen improvement there? And is the sort of thing we're talking about here happening in South America, or are peer pressure groups being formed?
It's funny because I am really a Latin Americanist, but there's stories in my book from every continent except Latin America. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Nothing in there.
Because
from
we have
South
seen
America.
Major changes in Chile,
right.
And,
yes,
and,
we have.
And
yes.
Brazil and Argentina.
No, things have greatly improved in many countries, and some not so much, and some they're going backwards. But that's really not in this book.
Maybe the next book.
Maybe the next one.
Meanwhile, we have Join the Club, How Peer Pressure Can Transform the World, written by Tina Rosenberg, who has won both a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. This book is published by Norton. And Tina, it's a great pleasure having you on our show today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.